Podo. You're listening to The Election Tricycle with Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin and Rohan Venkat.
Hello and welcome to The Election Tricycle, a new podcast looking at three of the biggest elections in the world in one of the biggest years for elections in the whole history of the world. This year, 2024, there are elections in 76 countries, 43 of which will be free and fair, and as many as 4 billion people are going to have a vote somewhere in the world. What this show does is bring together three people from three of those countries that have elections, the United States of America, India, and the UK, and we're going to talk about those three elections, what they mean for their countries, what they mean for the world, and perhaps how they interact with each other.
But before we do any of that, we're going to tell you who we are. I'm Emily Tamkin. I'm a global affairs journalist. I write for a range of publications on a range of issues, most notably U.S. foreign policy, illiberalism around the world, and American Jewish politics and identities. My second book is called Bad Jews, which is on American Jewish identities and history. I have a Substack called ET Write Home, where each week I cover the news of the world, some news from Jewish politics and the Jewish world, and my views on one subject. So it's news, views, and Jews. I'm so happy to be with you guys. Tom, I just gave your name away, but do you want to tell us a bit about who you are?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Tom Hamilton. I'm a former political staffer. I used to work for the Labour Party in the UK for about 10 years, and now I work for Public First, which is a research and policy consultancy based in Westminster. I've been watching and taking part in elections in the UK for a while. I've got a long history of losing elections. I've played a very small part in three, and Labour lost all of them. But now that I'm not part of that system anymore, Labour's actually looking like it might, is currently the favourite to win in the UK. So that's something. I also have a Substack, as everyone must these days. My Substack is Dividing Lines, which is about political attack in the UK and how it works and why it matters. I'd turn to Rohan and ask, why are you here?
Thanks, Tom. My name is Rohan Venkat. I spent a decade as a political journalist in India, but I'm currently a non-resident scholar at the Center for the Advanced Study of India at the University of Pennsylvania in the States. And I also write India Inside Out, which is a newsletter, a Substack, covering Indian politics, foreign policy, and whatever I'm interested in India at the moment. Often very nerdy historical things end up there. Very excited as well to be talking about these three very different elections happening, not exactly simultaneously, but it's a remarkable time to be following democratic politics all over.
And I think it's fair to say that the three elections are probably getting different levels of coverage in the three different countries. Obviously, in each country, the home election is the most important one. Certainly from a UK point of view, there's a huge amount of interest in the US election and rather less interest, frankly, from the national media in what's going on in India. So I'm really interested to hear a lot more about what's happening there. Although this week there was one big story that certainly made the UK news in India, which I think we're going to get to later on. So the Indian general election, just to recap, is going to be happening in the first half of this year in April or May. I don't think we know the exact date yet. The UK election could happen in theory any time from now on until January next year, but most people think it's most likely to happen autumn, maybe November is the most likely date. And then, of course, the US election, the date is absolutely fixed. It will be in early November, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, we're marching. Time passes. The days tick closer. It will be in November.
Yeah, that's the one thing about the American system is that the timetable is always really, really clear the whole way through, from primaries through to the selection of candidates and then the general election. We know a long way in advance when it's happening and people can work towards it. In the UK, we've had a lot of elections in recent years, and then this is the first full term that a government has served without an election since the 2010 to 15 period. So we've kept on having to have elections to deal with various political crises. We may have our own political crises at the moment, but they haven't led to immediate elections. What we're going to do each week is talk about the big election events in the news. And I think it's probably fair to say that in the UK this week, there haven't been any really big election events. Someone tried to overthrow the Prime Minister last night, but that happened a lot and it didn't lead to anything. And that also happens a lot. But what's been going on in the news in your country? Should we start with America, where the primary season is in full swing?
Let's. I think we should. I'm delighted that we're starting. Well, delighted is it's more bittersweet than that, but I'm glad that we're starting this week because we have I would say, major domestic political election news to discuss in the United States. And it's a two-parter for me. So the first is Donald Trump is going to be the candidate. And we've known this for some time. I would argue that we've known this since 2021, when he was impeached in the Senate the second time, and the Senate didn't vote to convict, which would have meant
Is he really going to be the candidate?
Yeah. So if they had voted to convict him, that would have meant that he could never have held public office again, which one might think would be like an appropriate consequence for, at minimum, encouraging people with weapons to march on the Capitol during election certification. But that didn't happen. So he's running again. And originally, you know, there were some running against him. That field has been whittled down. And this week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, about whom there was great excitement in some corners for a while there, dropped out. Ron DeSantis did not run a good campaign. First of all, rather than running as the figure of like the more competent Trump, which I imagine there is an audience for, he tried to run to Trump's right, sort of, and peel off his most devoted followers. This didn't work. He also ran what I would describe as an extremely online campaign. So going after university administrators, which makes a lot of sense if you spend time on Twitter and are like, yeah, I'm all worked up about diversity initiatives and wokeness, but I don't know that the average voter is like that hyped to go out and vote to take down a university administrator. During the course of this campaign, however, Donald Trump said, and I have a reason for listing the following. Donald Trump was very offended that Ron DeSantis was running against him, because how could he after all that Trump had done for him? Over the course of this campaign, Trump said the following of Ron DeSantis. He had said that he had begged on his knees for Trump's endorsement. He said that he wore high heels. He implied that maybe he was a pedophile. He said that under national scrutiny, he would whine for his mother. He called him Ron DeSanctimonious. He said he needed a personality transplant and implied that he does not have testicles. I am listing all this because Ron DeSantis then endorsed Donald Trump.
And he implied that he eats ice cream with his fingers or something to that effect.
Pudding. Worse than ice cream. No. I think it's important to note that like this is still Donald Trump's party. So much so that Trump said all of this about Ron DeSantis. These horrible, personal, degrading, demeaning, like in addition to January 6th, and in addition to the fact that he has been found liable for sexual abuse by a court, and in addition to all, you know, even if none of that bothers you, one would imagine that personally being told, oh, maybe you're a pedophile, would be like the part where Ron DeSantis would get off. He did not. He's staying on the Trump train. So now really the only viable candidate, such as one exists, against Trump is Nikki Haley. The New Hampshire primary was, we're recording this on Wednesday. It was on Tuesday evening, and Trump won, although not as handily as some might have expected. So I think while we've seen a lot of media coverage of like, oh, Biden, are his supporters going to come out? Which is a real question, and we will speak in subsequent weeks more about why that is. My guess is that we're now going to hear that about Trump. But at the same time, it's him. He's been confirmed as the only real viable game in town, even as we're seeing that there perhaps isn't the enthusiasm that there was in 2016 and 2020 for our former president.
So how could anyone in the Republican Party beat Donald Trump?
Here's the thing. They would have to stop living in fear, right? Because even Nikki Haley right now, and I should say she wants to hang on until the South Carolina primary because she was governor of that state at one point. One would think that she would have support there. Perhaps she can turn it around there. She only recently started pointing out things like Trump was doing a rally and seemed to confuse Nikki Haley with Nancy Pelosi, who was Speaker of the House on January 6th, which obviously Nikki Haley was not. If you're running against Trump, why are you waiting until now to point out that he's clearly not fit for this position? And the reason is that they're still afraid, right? They're afraid of him. They're afraid of his supporters. You know, they're afraid of their future in the Republican primary. And I don't think you win. Tom, you would know better than I, but I don't think that you win a campaign anywhere in this world by running scared. And that's what they've done. Like, I mean, this is really what Ron DeSantis' gamble was, right? Like, can you walk the line between flattering Trump and running against Trump? How are you going to win doing that? So I don't actually think we've seen what it would look like. I guess Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey, who helped sort of tried, but I think he's such an unpopular figure politically. Like, I don't think that we saw a figure who could have done this do it.
Yeah.
One of the things that jumps out, at least from afar, is the sheer amount of money that goes into these primaries, mm-hmm. some of which seemed very unlikely to go anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm curious, does all that money that was backing DeSantis, for example, now just fall in line behind Trump, or do those people go quiet?
This is a great point. I'm so glad you brought this up, because we're already seeing the business community that was like, shocked and appalled in 2021 start to line up again behind Trump, which is sort of interesting because the economy is actually good right now. But they think, I think the thinking for many of them is that a Republican president will be better. And if he is the president, they want to have good working relations with him. So we saw, for example, Jamie Dimon at the World Economic Forum saying, well, we need to respect how our fellow citizens feel about Trump. And it's like, first of all, why are you giving us the dispatch of the common man from the World Economic Forum? Second of all, like, it's you. You're talking about yourself, right? So I think the money will line up behind Trump. And I think the business community writ large will as well. But I sort of wanted to lead this into your country, because I think that one thing that I have been told is that we in the United States, or just around the world, don't sort of think about the connection between like capitalist fervor and support for the BJP that exists in India. And I'm sort of wondering if you could speak a bit about why this was such a historic week in Indian politics and how we saw that marriage of money and political passion.
Yeah, it's quite a week to be starting the podcast as well on the Indian side, because this is truly a momentous week, not just in Indian politics or electoral issues, but in the history of the Indian Republic. And that's not because Republic Day is around the corner or when we honor that past. It's because Modi, the Prime Minister of India, inaugurated a temple this week, a grand new temple to Ram, who is the god whose story is told in the epic known as the Ramayana. It's very hard to do a potted history of this temple, but I'm going to try in a short period, which is, this is or has been depicted as essentially a national monument, a national temple. India didn't really have a centralized form of religion historically, and Hinduism has often been considered much more heterodox than the big Abrahamic faiths, for example. But the Hindu right, the majoritarian nationalists, whose ideology powers the current government in India, have often sought to mold the religion into something that can be unifying and to create India as, in the aims of a number of those folks, a Hindu Rashtra, which would be a Hindu nation. For those who are not familiar, when India and Pakistan were carved out, as the British were leaving in the 40s, Pakistan chose to be expressly a state for Muslims, but India's founding father, so to speak, at the time, decided to go with a secular republic, one that would not have secularism in the way that, say, France does it, but would keep a separation of temple and state, so to speak. And in the eyes of many, what's happened over the last 10 years, and then most specifically this week, is a very clear merger of religion and state. To a certain extent, India's not officially changed anything in its constitution. It's not altered the way things are set up. And yet, Modi didn't just attend the inauguration of this temple, but presided over it and announced in his speech afterwards that this is a temple of India's vision, of India's philosophy. It's a temple of national consciousness, and said that Ram is the faith of India and the foundation of India. It is the idea of India.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if you could just briefly speak about why the site of this temple is so important and so controversial, and why saying that the site of this temple being the site of India's faith is likely quite disconcerting for many in India.
Yeah, and so that's the hard bit to get into the history of, but specifically it may sound similar to, you know, strongmen in other parts of the world, let's say, attempting to ally themselves to religious causes. But in India, this is particularly significant because the current government and its sort of majoritarian impulses are built on othering the Muslim minority in India, which is maybe about 10% of India's population, but that amounts to hundreds of millions of people. This was the site of a mosque that was built, we believe, about 500 years ago. It's not clear exactly when, and we don't know, but it was a medieval mosque built under the Mughals, which was the Central Asian dynasty that ruled India or North India at the time. But more specifically, over the course of the first in the 20s and then much more so in the 1980s, the Hindu right, which was then a small portion of Indian electoral politics, but a big part of, say, the social scene in India, saw in this site the potential to turn religion and politics into something that brings a big part of the vote base behind it. There's some documentation that this city in North India, Ayodhya, is the site where Ram is believed to have lived, and in this particular spot where he was born. they sold the idea that there was a grand temple there that was demolished by the invading Muslim kings of the time. And so there was a campaign, particularly in the late 1980s, to demolish this mosque and stick a temple on top of it. In 1992, that eventually happened, but not by any government decree, but a mob of Hindu right-wing activists managed to bring down the mosque, and it has been disputed since then. In 2019, the Indian Supreme Court, despite calling that demolition illegal, awarded the land to the Hindu party in the title dispute and gave the central government charge of building a Ram temple there. Again, it might be a bit too short to get into all the details here, but effectively, this is not just the central government attempting to build a national identity of India that runs through a sense of Hindu nationalism, but doing so expressly over a violent vigilante action that took place 30 years ago that cements the idea of the Muslim other in India and builds Hindu national political consciousness on that sense of othering the Muslim minority. So it pulls together a lot of different strains of what's happening in Indian politics at the moment, in part by cementing Hindu nationalism as the big force in opposition to, say, the Nehruvian secularism of the 50s and 60s. The othering of the Muslim minority, but also the falling in line, as you implied at the start of this conversation, of much of Indian society behind this. Whereas the demolition of the mosque in the 90s was considered a national shame to many people, considered it something that was bad, including in civil society and the business community. When the temple was inaugurated this week, you had practically all of India's top folks from across, you know, whether it was Bollywood, whether it was big business, whether it was members of the judiciary, of the military, it was all of society turning up to be present at this grand unveiling. And the context, of course, is that actually the temple is not finished. It's not likely to be finished anytime soon, but Modi wanted to get it done ahead of elections that are, Tom, that could happen anytime. In fact, just like in Britain, they could call for elections anytime now.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, how controversial is it within India? How contested is that? Because you said that when it originally happened in 1992, it was seen as a source of shame by many people. We've now come to a situation where, you know, they're reading out in the UK news some of the celebrities who were present, people that even we've heard of in the UK, the sort of people who you wouldn't expect to want to get involved in a political controversy. And is that because it isn't really a political controversy? I mean, are the BJP's opponents publicly arguing against what's happening, or are they keeping their heads down?
So, yeah, the opposition chose not to attend, or a bulk of the opposition chose not to attend, attempting to decry the event as a political affair rather than as a national or a religious one. But they haven't been able to a large extent, to put forward an alternative narrative there. There were efforts here and there, but they're struggling to deal with this issue because the broad consciousness, the success of the BJP's narrative building efforts over the last 10 years has been to make it non-controversial. Its roots remain controversial. And for those who pay attention, again, remember, this is 30 years ago, and the bulk of India is also relatively young. And so the history of the controversy is almost in the past to many. The BJP also made efforts to make it non-controversial in a certain sense, which is to say that they could have, through parliament or through public decree, ordered the making of the temple, but they chose to wait, so to speak, for a judicial decree that gave the land over to the central government and ordered the building of a temple. Now, there's another whole discussion to be had about how the judiciary has responded to the rise of Hindu majoritarianism in India. But Modi expressly thanked the Supreme Court for its decision in his speech following the inauguration. And he spoke of it as saying, as the pride of India and the fact that the inauguration didn't lead to, you know, large-scale violence. In part, as you said, because those who are opposed to it have, not necessarily opposed to the temple, let's say, but opposed to the way it has played out, have kept their heads down and been unable to engage with this presentation of it as being a matter of faith and an important part of India's consciousness. So the BJP has been very successful at essentially making it non-controversial, even though the roots of it are deeply contested.
Can I ask you a really basic question about the Indian election, which is, I think it's broadly thought that the BJP are the favourites to win the election, but How overwhelming favorites are they? How up for grabs is the election really?
I would imagine it's kind of like the Republican primary. India's a parliamentary system like the UK, and people are not voting for the prime minister, though Modi has been extremely successful at turning this into a quasi-presidential election over the last decade in telling voters expressly that they're voting for the prime minister and not necessarily for their local candidate. So even if they are unhappy with their local member of parliament, that every vote for a BJP MP is a vote for him directly. They are overwhelming favorites in the sense that they are expected to easily get a majority in parliament and probably to make gains. They won 303 out of 543 seats in 2019, 5 years ago in the elections. And most expectations today, particularly after the sheer success and the lack of an opposition narrative, the opposition have sought to unite under a common banner, but they struggle to present a cohesive argument for what makes them different from the BJP. They've known for a while that this inauguration, for example, was coming, but they failed to really either have a united stand on it or even to present something as a response. And so I'd say at the moment, they're overwhelming favorites, with, of course, the caveat being India's big and federal, and there's lots of interesting battles playing across the country that we'll presumably get into over the course of this podcast.
At the moment, we have overwhelming favourites in the UK election as well. The Labour Party has been 15 to 20 points ahead for well over a year now, and you know, things could change. People in the Labour Party don't necessarily believe that they've got it sewn up, but the polls haven't moved for quite a long time. It feels at the moment like the US election might be the closest one, but at the same time, I think certainly the UK coverage has a general tenor of Trump's going to get back in, probably. How probable would you say it is, or is it really up for grabs, Emily?
I think it's likely, but I also think it's closer than the sort of media narrative until yesterday would have made it seem. There was some poll that showed that a study that showed that a problem Biden had is that people didn't really believe that Trump would be the candidate, right? Like, they didn't really believe that this could happen again. And so now I think we'll see, okay, now that that's becoming more likely, like, do people remember 2016 to, let's say, 2020, or let's say 2015 to 2021, right? And will that actually help them at the polls? And what to sort of signpost where we're going with this podcast, you know, to what extent does Biden's support for Israel's war in Gaza continue to hurt him with younger Democrats, with the left? Mm-hmm. To what extent does Trump's whole thing hurt him with more moderate Republicans, such as they are, and independents? These two men yelling at each other, you don't know where you are. No, you don't know where you are. Like, who's more believable? You know, how does any of this play out? So I think it will be close. I also just think that it's just so hard to predict what happens between now and November. Before we close this segment of our very first election tricycle, Tom, you did mention that something happened that turned out to be nothing in British politics. And while I would love to leave that joke just there, do you want to just briefly tell us what that was?
Yeah, let me try and explain what's happened. So as I just said, the polls have not moved for some time. The Conservative Party, who have been in power in the UK either on their own or in coalition since 2010, are quite substantially behind, and if nothing changes, they will lose. That's how these things work. And Conservative MPs are very aware of that. And under Rishi Sunak's leadership, Sunak has been in charge since late 2022, following a period of 49 days when Liz Truss was Prime Minister, and things didn't go very well, and she was booted out pretty quickly. He's been in office since then, and despite being, I think, fairly obviously more competent than Truss, despite not having made any massive mistakes of the types that she made, and despite not having some of the previous problems that Boris Johnson had that led to him being ejected from office in the summer of that year, he also just hasn't moved the dial. So he came in with the Conservative Party very unpopular and himself relatively popular. And you've got to a position where the Conservative Party is just as unpopular, and he has lost popularity to sort of sink to their level. There are various reasons for that. Part of them are about him, but fundamentally it's about the fact that the economy hasn't been a particularly strong state. Inflation has been pretty high, and almost all of the things that he said that he was going to deliver over the last year or so haven't happened yet. When leaders aren't doing well, people start to get agitated and think that someone else might be better. And last night, someone who's billed as a senior Conservative MP, and you'll be aware of the media shorthand. Whenever anyone says anything interesting, they are senior and important. So Sir Simon Clarke, who was very briefly a cabinet minister under Liz Truss, was not a Rishi Sunak supporter at the time that he became Prime Minister, came out and wrote an article in the Daily Telegraph to say that Sunak should stand down and be replaced by someone else. He didn't say who else it should be. He was unable to come up with an alternative. He made it very clear that he wasn't proposing himself as the alternative, which is just as well, because he wouldn't be a particularly credible option. One of the notable things that happened was that nothing happened, as in there was not a groundswell of support from other Conservative MPs. A lot of Tory MPs said on and off the record that this was a stupid thing for him to have done, and he appears to be completely isolated. The other thing that happened alongside this call for Sunak to go was the publication of a very interesting poll by the same paper. A poll that showed that if you ask the public who they prefer out of Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer, who's the Labour Party leader, overwhelmingly people prefer Keir Starmer. But if you ask them who they prefer out of Keir Starmer or an unnamed Conservative,
who governs
with true Conservative values, who stops the boats, which is the sort of sloganeering shorthand for cutting immigration in the UK, who brings down NHS waiting lists, who cuts taxes and cuts crime, which of those would you prefer?
And I found this so funny. I saw that. It was like, who do you want to date? Like your boyfriend or your imaginary dream man? It's like, well,
exactly.
I mean, hopefully your boyfriend, but imaginary dream man isn't walking through that door, as they say.
Yeah, it's really striking that there is not an imaginary dream man or woman on the Conservative benches, and no one's been able to identify anyone who could fulfill that role, which I think is one reason why nobody particularly supported Simon Clarke. What I thought was most interesting about that quite ridiculous polling question was that even against your imaginary dream man, Keir Starmer still wins 160-odd seats, and then
good
there are
Keir,
still
you know,
80
good
don't
know. No, that, but to your point, like that's just how it just seems that people are tired of this party being in power right now. Like it's been a long time. They've had ample opportunity to.
Well, I think people are, and I think they are as well, and they're behaving as if they are.
Yeah.
And you get to a point after a while where parties, you know, and this isn't just a partisan point about the Tories now. It happened to the Labour Party a decade and a half ago. It's happened to other parties before, where parties sort of turn in on themselves, run out of things that they want to do for the future. I'm openly partisan as a former Labour staffer, but there is a genuine question about whether the Tories could govern effectively for another five-year term if they somehow won the next election. I think they've really run out of things to do. But, you know, it could still happen. They might find their imaginary dream prime minister, their dream leader. I think the other thing is, if you'd said to the Labour Party in 2019 or in 2015 that they wouldn't have a chance of winning an election until there'd been another four Tory prime ministers, I think most people would have thought, well, we're looking at decades out of office. And it turns out the shelf life of a Tory prime minister has dropped to, almost nothing. So we had the 49 days of Truss, we had 3 years of Johnson, we had 3 years of May. We might get as much as 2 years of Sunak. These are not people who are stamping their mark on the UK for long periods. We are becoming a slightly unstable country, even if not one that can elect anyone other than the Tories.
Well, till next time with that. Listeners, I have bad news and good news. So the bad news is that normally this will be where our podcast shuts off for you, unless you subscribe to the premium edition by subscribing to one of those Substacks that we mentioned at the top of this program. The good news is that this week for our first edition, to sort of let you know the quality content that will be behind said paywall, here's the little bonus of the election tricycle. So in the future, we will have listener questions that you can tweet at us or write to us and that we will answer. But this week we've had a question sent in from our producer, Nick. So Nick's question is, can you each say how much, if any, discussion is being given to other countries' elections in your own nation's political discourse? I will just say very little, you know, and it's not, I don't even mean this in the sense of like, America doesn't care about other countries. I just think that our own campaign takes up so much oxygen. I think that's a shame because there are, like, I think that what was being described earlier in India, you know, there are elections around the world that I can point to that I think have really relevant lessons for the United States that unfortunately we're not learning, but hopefully listeners will get some of that on this podcast. What about you guys?
Well, certainly in the UK, there always is a huge amount of interest in the US election, at least in terms of media coverage. Whether the public are all that interested is a slightly different question, but it always gets covered a lot. So certainly on the news that I listened to this morning, the New Hampshire primary was the top story over anything that was happening in the UK, including the story I was just talking about Simon Clark. So maybe that says good things about the UK's interest in foreign policy, although probably not, because there's a lot less coverage of almost any of the other elections going on around the world. It was actually really unusual this week to hear coverage of what was going on in Georgia, which was a major story in the UK. In general, we're just not hearing anything like as much about what is the single biggest election that's due in 2024. It doesn't get anything like the same level of coverage. Rohan, what kind of interest is there in either the US or the UK election?
The US election, I think, as with everywhere else, there's always going to be attention paid to it. There's also a huge Indian population in the US. And so there's regardless of that, Trump also gathers eyeballs no matter what. So the American election, tremendously so. There remains a small Anglophile population of India that will pay attention to British politics. And the fact that Rishi Sunak is in the race, in one sense, means that there is, you know, a certain amount of attention, but much less attention to the details of the race. But the success of Indian origin folks like Rishi or Suella, for example, those things will get lots of attention, I think, in India, but not the broader contours of the British race.
And then before we let you go, listeners, each week we will introduce you to a character from one of our country's political dramas, let's call them. This week, I'm going to very briefly introduce you to a gentleman by the name of Dean Phillips. Dean Phillips is a congressman from Minnesota who decided that somebody needed to challenge Biden and that person should be him. So he is running a campaign, not very successfully. He did not win New Hampshire, despite the fact that Joe Biden was a write-in candidate on that ballot. I think he's tried to get a conversation going about how sort of it's time to pass the baton. I personally don't disagree with that. I do think that it's pretty clear that most people don't see Dean Phillips as the person to whom that baton should be passed. But that's, you know, that's Phillips' prerogative. And with that, Tom, do you want to get us out of here?
Thanks for listening, and join us again next time.
The Election Tricycle is a Poddo podcast hosted by Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin, and Rohan Venkat. It is series produced by Nick Hilton. Tweet us at Tricycle2024 and watch a video version of the show at cooler.news. For sales and advertising, please email nick@podopods.com. podopods.com.